The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Hello, and welcome to the American College of Osteopathic Internists Annual Convention and Scientific Sessions. This year's meeting was held in conjunction with the Annual Clinical Assembly of the American College of Osteopathic Surgeons. The meeting was held October 11th through 15th, 2017, and featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of interest to the practicing physician. The meeting was held at the Gaylord National Resort and Convention Center in National Harbor, Maryland. The program chair is Dr. Annette Karen, and the theme for this year's presentations is Goldilocks Medicine, Not Too Little, Not Too Much. The ACOI-ACOS Joint Plenary Session keynote speaker is Dr. Zubin Damania, also known as Z-Dog MD.
Let me talk to him. Let me talk to him.
What a pain.
Baxter off to him. Come on. Shorty has some apple bottom scrubs. Crocs with the fur. The whole day doing Medicare. The MPO. She checked glucose. Sugar got low, 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 low. Baggy boot bombs and the bands go with the strap. Turn around and go to big booty a pap. They got a code. Won't raise your throat. Shorty's like, no, 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 no. Hey, I never seen nothing that'll fix the flow. Them patients lined up waiting to go. Bought $1 million EMR to blow. Press game, never seen a score so low. So sensible, she's flexible, professional, billing extra coats. Hold up, wait a minute, do I see a drug rep on her? Did a thing, I seen Shorty ride nose. Copy, paste, and then the thing froze. Make it rain, tech making it slow. Work the coats to make the payroll. I'ma say that I can't send it no more. Revenue flat, reimbursement so low. PA helps that patient slammed up the dough. But my MA always know where they go. She had them apple bottom scrubs. Cracks to the phone. Truck seekers yelling at her. With the toe. It's way past four. Shorty's like, no, 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 no. The baggy short pants and the tourniquet strap. Turn around and gave a big AC a smack. She hit the floor. Next thing you know, patient got low, 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 low. Hey, shorty, what I gotta do to get your room? Schedule jam-packed for a nasty room. Double look, got stacks of people left to do. EMR so whack, makes a meaningful use. One click, two clicks, three clicks, and that's 1 minute. What you think I'm playing? I'm just looking for the man and the facts so we can. That's when I told them I said people posers. They are patient soldiers. This pop over posers got them all bipolar. They are working over, burnt out like a toaster. Insurance the government try to control her. All these bean counters are jokers. Patients keep watching these shows. Some of her eyes is a poser. She showed her apple bottom scrubs, Crocs with the fur. PMA nurse practitioners. We got this low. That team will stop. Then it got flow, 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 flow. Hey.
You know, I imagine that's hard to hear this early in the morning. It's even harder to do this early in the morning after two cups of that brown placebo they call coffee in the room. Did anyone have that? Yeah, I was like, it looks like coffee, it smells like coffee, but I'm not convinced it's coffee. By the way, thank you for that really kind introduction. Like, that was actually the most, like, actually descriptive introduction because it was done by a surgeon. It was like, you know, the wound was incised at approximately 343, it was entered. And I was like, wow, he actually went back to Cal Berkeley and all that. Usually it's like, yeah, this is some old Stanford guy who liked raps and stuff. So thank you for that. Now, speaking of all that, I want to talk today about Hannah Montana. Obviously. So when we go down our paths, right, medical school, right, the D to the O, you know what I'm saying? Aren't we like her? We go in so idealistic. We're like, I'm going to use my unique gifts to change the world. And we're super Disney. We barely curse. And then I don't know, man, if it's the 12th time you've done that, you know, prior auth call, or you're trying to figure out what the hell MACRA stands for, or, you know, you're up in the middle of the night, you know, you're an internist and you're getting that call for the earache and you're like, you know, there's a thing called Dr. Google, man, just use it. But one day you look in the mirror and that reflection has changed. And you're like, dang, man, all this time I was just a twerk in progress. What's going on? And, you know, in many ways, our healthcare system has done this same transformation. It has gone from this sacred art that was physician-led, where we had autonomy, where we had time with our patients, where we connected with our colleagues, right? And we were unfettered by things like evidence and population health and systems thinking and those sort of things and cost, that sort of stuff. But it didn't matter because we ran the show. That was health 1.0. It was a beautiful golden age in the 20th century that many of us wish could reappear. But what was the response to that? Health 2.0. Because people are like, this is expensive, there's fraud, there's inconsistent quality, there isn't a lot of science involved. So let's do this. Let's treat medicine like a business. Carrots and sticks and click, 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 click in an electronic medical record. And let's make algorithms and a sort of a cookbook approach where everybody, both doctors and patients and staff, feel like commodities. And that is the assembly line world of health 2.0. And that's where we see this, right? Where we need like a Twerkman's comp policy just to practice. And the question is, in this talk, is how do we, and you guys are unique in that you have a kind of training, and I feel it. When I was sitting here doing selfies before the thing started, there's a warmth that you guys exhibit that I rarely see from physicians, and I'm gonna not attribute it to the fact that half of you are surgeons, because that terrifies me. By the way, have you ever noticed that internists get really upset about the whole procedure thing? Like, well, no, we do procedures too. Our procedure is our note. Like we actually write a procedure note about our note. Like a pen was laid to paper at approximately 3:43. Complications, ink blotch on line 3. Whiteout was applied gingerly. Copies were sent to medical records. Thank you, end of dictation. I actually attribute it to the fact that you guys have a type of training in the osteopathic tradition that is more holistic, it is more embracing. And so you guys are actually the first to suffer in this system. And by the way, I've had this slide up, oh good, it's gone, way too long, because usually she's just there twerking the whole time and people are like, I'm starting to get uncomfortable. So the question is, if you go from this, what is health 3.0? A repersonalized, reconnected, transformative and compassionate system where physicians lead, but they're part of a team, where we treat each other like we're all the most important person in service of the patient, but we also take care of each other, and we're paid on actual outcomes, and the technology leverages those outcomes and then gets the hell out of the way. That is health 3.0. And I'm hoping that it does not look like this. I'm sorry, I thought I was dealing with a room full of internists and surgeons. Like, you would think at this point you guys would have seen enough right prosthetic hips. It is funny though how sometimes we can look at an image and miss the elephant in the rectum. Could you imagine what the radiology report was? Oh my gosh. And you're like, yeah, there's a well-seated right prosthetic hip with surrounding mild osteopenia. Normal bowel gas pattern. Incidentally noted, is an oblong ground glass opacity, shape consistent with Coke, cannot rule out Pepsi, suggest clinical correlation. Yeah. You think, Ace? How much do you get paid? What's going on? My wife's a radiologist, so I can make fun of them and then get beaten up at home. So, the question is, how do we get to 3.0? 3.0 does not look like this. because this is my dad. I know you guys are like, what? Like, there's no phenotypic resemblance between these two characters. But no, I did the genetic testing, man. This is my dad. He's from, primary care physician from India, trained there, came here, foreign medical graduate. Now they call him international medical graduates because it sounds more, James Bondish. And my mom, also from India, a psychiatrist. Explains the whole damn thing. Also explains why I was always grounded in exactly 72-hour increments as a child. Took me a long time to get to the bottom of that Scooby-Doo mystery. But look, who's got immigrant parents here? Yeah, a bunch of people, right? When you have two Indian immigrant physician parents, what are you going to do when you grow up? Are you going to be an artist? No. We know the struggle is real. Like, there is no test that they will not criticize, even a blood test. The struggle is real. And so I'm growing up with this guy, right? I'm born in Morristown, New Jersey. Yeah, there's always like a couple people who are like, New Jersey! I don't know who these people are. But my dad, comes with nothing in his pocket, does a second residency along with my mom, and then moves us from Morristown, where I was, in the Kimberly Academy for the Gifted private school. And, I was super ahead of the curve because I had childhood obesity before it was cool. And yet I was accepted and my funny accent was accepted and all of that. And he moved me to rural Clovis, California. Yeah, no one cheering for that. There's one person who tentatively was like, And this was, okay, he wanted to start a private practice. My mom wanted to start a private practice. So now suddenly, I'm a chubby Indian kid with a funny last name and an accent out of New Jersey, going from the Kimberly School for the Gifted to Dry Creek Elementary. This was a recipe for Wedgie's Q1 hour round the clock with a PRN wet willy. And so I realized at this point I had two gifts and I used them to defend myself. The first was I could read minds. And many of you have this gift. It's a kind of a telekinesis. Nowadays they call it, empathy or some crap like that. But I could literally figure out how people were feel that, and then use my second gift, which was humor, to disarm them, to put them at ease, by feeling what was bothering them and make a joke about it. And suddenly I went from the guy getting the wedgies to the guy who was invited to all the parties and the class clown and all that other jazz. And I got into music and I got into teaching and I loved that using humor to try to break down walls. So in high school, my dad asked me, hey, what are you gonna do when you grow up? And I said, I'm gonna be like my hero. And you could tell at that point, he's swelling, he's like, and I said, yeah, Weird Al. And you know the thing Indian guys do when they're pissed, or when they're happy, or when they're sad? He starts doing this and he goes, being a professional clown won't put naan on the table, okay, buddy? Why don't you come to my clinic, you'll see what I do, and then you will see what you are going to do. And I did. I went to his clinic, and this is what I saw. I saw the beauty and the art and the sacredness of health 1.0. I saw a guy who didn't, he wasn't trained to order a ton of tests. He was trained to use intuition and touch and the, heaven forbid, the physical exam, and to think about a patient holistically and think of in terms of the community and spend time with the patients. And I remember he had this guy came in with right upper quadrant pain. And I'd been reading, and I'm like, hey, Pops, we should do an ultrasound because, apparently, you can use sound waves to, see in there and, do stuff. And he looked at me, and he was like, ultrasound. No wonder the Americans are spending $2.8 trillion with a T on the healthcare and getting the worst outcomes in the developed nation. They are thinking that money is growing on vines only. Ultrasound. I have perfectly good fingers. And I said, oh my God, what is gonna happen? Is this gonna be like that time when, all of us who are children of doctors know you don't ever see a real doctor when you're young? Like one time I complained of back pain and he was like, drop your pants. I said, why is this happening right now? And he said, I need to check your S5 to make sure there is no damage to the nerve root. And I said, how do you do that? And he said, you'll see. After that, I had Child Protective Services on speed dial. But so I was worried something was going to go down. So he goes up to this patient and he goes, hey, Bob, you know, how are you doing? How's the cat? The cat is okay? I know you're having the pain only, but, you know, your wife is doing okay? Yes? Okay. Then he cracks his knuckles. No reason. Just to establish that he is the authority figure in the room. And he starts percussing. And if you've ever heard an Indian-trained doctor percuss, it's like the frickin' hammer of Thor. He was like... There is a 2.5 centimeter shadowing gallstone at the neck of the gallbladder with trace pericardial fluid. Mild percussographic Murphy sign. Suggest clinical correlation. And I was like, Dad, did you just percuss an acute cholecystitis and give me a radiology report complete with a hedge? I want to do what you do when I grow up. You're right. That is the dopest thing I've ever seen in my life. And he was like, you are the dopest thing I've ever seen in my life. You want to do what I do when you grow up. Don't be an idiot. What I do is dying away. You know, they want me now to see 30, 40 patients in the clinic and clicking on this mice all day. Click, click, click. I'm like, you know what? OSHA will have something to say if you bring mice into my clinic. All of this just to pay the secretaries overhead. And I said, you don't have secretaries. And he said, see? I won't do it. What I'm doing is dying away, okay? They are not paying you to do things for people. They are paying you now to do things to people, especially to the butthole. You know your uncle Rashid? That's right, his first name was Rashid, and his last name was Rashid, which is why he always got two cavity searches at the TSA every time. Your uncle, Rashid, did the GI, okay? He knew there are 5,000 rupees in everybody's colon. Just take a scope and fish it out. Why don't you do that? You know, look at him. What is he driving? Every day, he goes to work. The patient is unconscious in the prone position. He doesn't have to talk. And he is playing video games inside their buttocks. Look what he drives. Lexus. All day I spend holding the hand, doing the disability paperwork, doing the TAR on the phone, going to the house, making the relationships. What do I drive? Look. Camry. Fabric interior. I said, Dad, a Camry's really a more sensible version of the Lexus in the end, isn't it? I mean, it's built on the same chest. Shut up and don't talk back. And that was literally the advice from Health 1.0, that old paternalistic system, right, to the son. You're going to have to be a proceduralist or you're never going to survive in what is coming, which is Health 2.0. And those of y'all who are proceduralists know that he wasn't even right about that. Because then I said, you know what? No. In my rebel stance, I'm gonna do general medicine. I'm gonna do primary care. I'm gonna do whatever because I'm the bomb and I'm better than that and it's gonna be dope, right? Wrong, because this was medical school. I don't know how osteopathic medical school was, but I know how UCSF was. This kind of education had completely bypassed the Renaissance Enlightenment. The Enlightenment was about questioning authority, the scientific method, constantly striving to make things better. My medical school was about the Greek method, which was fealty to authority and taking facts from a sage on the stage that have been passed down for millennia, 50% of which will be proven to be incorrect, and they don't have the courtesy to tell you which 50%. The first 2 years you memorize, spit it out on the boards. The second 2 years, it's about kissing the ring of the authority figure, the attending physician, with the contract being that one day you will be the ring that is kissed. And this sort of blind obeisance to authority is a perfect vehicle, perfect incubator for innovative thinking, team-based care, collaboration, you know, lack of inertia. And now we have the system that we have, and partially we are to blame because we've been complicit in this. And I thought when I graduated, though, even though most of that telekinetic gift had been beaten out of me and I no longer was able to sense other people's pain because I built a wall around myself, I still thought I was going to be that Hannah Montana doc who used his unique gifts to change the world, right? But what did I meet? The beginnings of Health 2.0. They said, yo, check it out. There's this great thing called the electronic health record. And it's super dope, and it's going to make you more efficient and safer, and it's going to change your practice for the better and serve patients, right? How'd that work out for us? I wrote a little poem about it. You guys want to hear it? It's called EHR State of Mind. Or not. Let's go back and do that again. You guys ready? Anesthesia, come on. Don't make me blame you for this. See what I did there? Yeah, I'm out that paper. No more chasing med records. Writing so illegible that I'll be hipper forever. Bought the new software, and though we use it here, I can't use it over there. Different systems everywhere. I used to chart on paper. All of my verbals recorded, mixed up with the ward clerk. Turned diluted to dilaudid. Switch me to that EMR. Meaningless abuse. Gee, now catch me at the nurse's station, mashing that F2 key. Notes used to be a sorry narrative, but yo, replaced with copy paste. Now a bloated ransom note. Me, I'm at that bedside, focused like a laser beam on the patient. Come on, I'm treating the computer screen. 8 dozen warnings, click check boxes, alarm fatigue, Vaseline conflicts with doxy. Nurses, they be burned out, we could use some OT. Tell by our wrist guards that we most definitely yeah. I made you hot, ACOS. You're gone.
We need a new child.
They built us a turd, Stacks. Catch me on the phone with IT, begging tech support. Shooters like IT and me be stuck in 1994. Innovation all round, but it ain't in healthcare. Internet and apps for you, but we get ancient software. Welcome to that EHR. Go live and it don't stop. Uncle Sam promoted it, but gone is the intro out. CMS, EMS, PMS, holler back. But doctors, it ain't fair. These vendors act like they all kinda whack. 8 million stories out there, docs can't take it. After this disaster, half of y'all won't make it. How to train your dragon, Hotmail isn't hot. Mail. If some be saying it's epic, we saying it's epic fail. Electronic silo, teams not talking. Paperless, they say, but whole trees we dropping. Props to case management, long live the RT, long live the pharmacist. Whole team definitely hates. Yeah.
Just a glorified billing platform with the patients obsessed on.
Right. You guys hear the track?
Because
I can't.
We need a new job.
Welcome to the apocalypse, Doc. Check it out, though. Tech should bond us, connect, not blind us, to the reason why we care. Patient's face reminds us. Designs like Hippocrates that tap the app agilely, then magically the team works. Let's bite the apple, Steve. Caught up in your inbox, now you're insane. Good doc's gone mad, the clinic's filled with them. Nursing, they the heart of everything. Data entry got them hurting. Life starts when the shift ends. 10 years of school, graduated to the OR. Mommy busts a ripple, she deserves a better damn chart. Autocorrect, turning Chantix into champion. Patient needs a sleep for 30 clicks for an Ambien. It's like a 90s cell phone in your car, son. You can make calls, but it sucks. Yes, the whole team. Word. I wrote that song after working with, you know, at Stanford as a hospitalist for 10 years. And I was there when the EHR went live. So I straddled both worlds. And I saw the beautiful promise of technology in reducing errors and all that. But I saw that it destroyed my life. And you'll see, you guys already know, but you'll see as the story progresses how. How does, by the way, how are the track soundings? The mix good and everything? Awesome. Good. Good. All right. Because we did like a 2/3 of a sound check, maybe a half. So that being said, at Stanford, what I started to notice in Health 2.0 is all our patients start to look the same because we're obsessed with algorithms and cookbooks and codes. They all start to look like this. I know, adorable, right? Y'all know better. Should I present Mr. Pooh to you? I see an anxious, concerned, affect concerning for the depression with anxiety features ICD-10-23-XD.01, first visit acute. I see a black necrotic nose concerning for likely cocaine ingestion. ICD-10-23-17.A6, bilateral first visit. I see considerable central obesity concerning for likely metabolic syndrome with insulin resistance, a finding confirmed and supported by the complete absence of fingers and toes on all of the extremities, concerning for diabetic polyneuropathy with autoamputation, and despite his name, he hasn't. Concerning for diabetic gastropathy with constipation. And despite this litany of glucose-related complaints, Mr. Pooh presents to your clinic with his auto-amputated right paw deep in a jar of honey. Now, in the brave new world where you've got to see 30 patients and you're paid on volume and you've got to click, click, click in the boxes, you've got maybe 20 minutes to see this new patient 99217 or whatever the CPT code is, right? I've already forgotten, but I see him as a series of zeros and ones because we live in the Medtrix. It's the hospital that's been pulled over our eyes to blind us to the truth that we are slaves. Right? And so, exactly. Whoa. And so, in the setting of this, I go, okay, the first 10 minutes of the visit, Mr. Pooh, what is that stack of papers you have in your hand? Oh, bother. Since my doctors don't have time to listen to me, I went to Dr. Oz's website. And I printed out some handouts on how honey can cure diabetes. There goes 10 minutes of the visit we're never going to get back, all right? And then the other 5 minutes, Pooh, what are your medications and allergies? Oh, bother. Isn't that in the computer? I'm sure it is. I'm sure it's in the McKesson across the street in the urgent care that you see, but we're on Epic over here, and those two systems don't talk to each other. So you're going to have to get Christopher Robbins, your homie, to walk over to that clinic, all right, and print out their record on their paperless system. You will then go to the owlry where you will attach it to an owl that will then fly it over here. Because yes, this is like Hogwarts. The medical system is a parallel universe where we're like 30 years behind on the technology and we have these arcane rituals and wear long white robes. And we have this thing called HIPAA that means we can't just say what's going on. And instead of saying hockaloogie, we say expectorate sputum. And you will then transfer it here where we will scan it in, okay? Another 5 minutes of discussion gone. Are those records ever going to come? Hell no. Now I've got 5 minutes to tell him that he's got a new diagnosis of diabetes. And so it's like this. Hey, Mr. Pooh, you're fat. You're fat. You are off thin. Because if you tell him he's obese or fat, think what that's going to do to your press gainy patient satisfaction scores. So you beat around the honeypot, and you say, you have this new thing of diabetes. You should walk. You should exercise. You shouldn't eat crap. Okay, done with that. here's 5 different medications, here's 6 different specialty referrals, here's 7 different tests, we're going to admit you to the hospital for 8 different days to amputate that 9th little bit of black toe. Number 10, here's a glucometer, keep a blood sugar log 4 times a day, don't eat crap, we'll see you in a month, thanks, bye. And then you start click, 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 and Pooh starts to saunter out of the room, still eating honey, walks down the hall, and then you realize you're looking through the boxes and you're like, damn it. Hey, yo, Pooh, don't smoke, bro. Click. $5 pre-tax. And now if Mr. Pooh comes back in a month, which is not a certain conclusion, he comes back, he's on 5 medications. Yay! It's the same medication he's taking 5 times a day. Boo! Because he went to try to fill it, but no one filled out the tar, and then the owl looking for the authorization got intercepted by Voldemort, and he's now on Glyburide 10 milligrams 4 times a day. And you're like, wait, despite this, your blood sugar 700. And at this point, you're just looking at him going, what? And you know, you, by the way, you interrogate his actual device, and it just says, OMG. You know, I didn't even know, and the second reading is a poo emoji. You're like, I didn't even know it could do that. And at this point, you know, it's academics, right? So it's a series of Russian nested eggs. You've seen those little eggs? You open up, it's like, here's your resident, and you open up the egg, and there's the intern, and you open up the egg, and there's the medical student, and you open up that egg, and there's Hannah Montana, whose dad's a doctor, and she's shadowing in the clinic because she's going to use her unique gifts to change the world. And at this point, the lead egg turns to the second egg and goes, hey, check it out, points at poo, looks at the poo emoji, and the sugar of 700, and the fact that he's still eating honey, and goes, you can't cure stupid. And at this point, the resident's like, yeah, buddy, that's it. Now you're spot on, and you can't cure stupid. And the medical student kind of looks at them and goes, damn, like, I thought I went into this to help people and change the world with my unique gifts, but in order to do that, I have to kiss the ring so I can get honors in this rotation. So, you can't cure stupid, tells it to Hannah Montana, who bursts into tears, runs off, goes home, and insta-tweet chats her friends that she has decided to become a lawyer and sue the crap out of doctors when she grows up, because these are horrible people. Now, we've all seen this, we've all been there. The question is, why would this go down in a tribe of healers? And I would argue it's because we feel incapable of treating what's really going on with Winnie the Pooh, right? We deeply feel broken because our system gives us no chance to help him, and we, instead of blaming ourselves, we have to externalize blame because it's the only way we can protect ourselves because it's scary. And so what ends up happening is, let's throw that Pooh slide back up. We don't ask, we don't have the capacity or the training or the incentive to say, what hole in your life is that honey filling, Pooh, that you're willing to eat it even though it's killing you? Is it a cultural thing with bears? Is it that you live in a food desert where honey is the cheapest thing you can get and we've taken it out of trees where it was guarded by bees and put it in every processed food? And you don't have the money to go to Whole Foods and buy, you know, non-honeyed equivalents? Like, what's going on with the 100 Acre Woods, your support network, your social determinants of health? Christopher Robbins, he's your homie, totally AWOL. What's going on with Piglet? Is there abuse? I've seen this before. Mr. Pooh, have you been dipping into Tigger's crystal meth stash? People who see this know what I'm talking about. And by the way, surgeons, don't even get me started on Eeyore. I don't even know how you get a scar like that. But I can guarantee you that no one has had an end-of-life discussion about Eeyore's wishes. And what's going to happen is Eeyore is going to end up pegged and trached on a ventilator in an ICU, and they are going to call the only contact they can find, which is Christopher Robbins, and his ass is 2 states away. And they go, what do you want to do? And he goes, do everything until I get there. When are you coming? I didn't say I was coming. And man, this little guy's so high on opioids, you don't even want to know. And in the setting of this, we wonder why 60% of doctors wouldn't recommend the career to their kids, why we burn out constantly. And you know, because we did everything. We did everything we were told. We were good soldiers. They said the only cure for burnout is to work harder. The only cure for doing the wrong thing is to just listen to what we're telling you. You'll do the right thing. And it's all going to be great. Wrong, because now our careers feel like this. We did everything and we're back here. That's how I felt. You know how I knew I was burned out? I started winning teaching awards. Because you know how you win teaching awards. Either you're that Socratic sage on the stage that downloads the information in a way that the kids can play it at 3x on their iPods and still understand it. Or you are the egg at the top who starts the, hey, you can't cure stupid. You are the one using your gift, say, I don't know who we're talking about here, humor, to actually now build a wall around your team and make them feel safe from the deep hurt that we feel when we can't do what we went into this to do, which is to care for fellow human beings, where everything gets in our way of our calling. And so we use humor to build this wall, and that's what I did, and that's why they gave me teaching awards, because it made them feel safe. I was poisoned by this culture, and I was poisoning them. I was like the fat man from House of God. And so in the setting of this, I knew, my daughter had come to me with a stethoscope. You know, she was like 4 or 5. She'd pulled my Lippmann out of my thing and put it over her shoulders, and I was there like charting or something. At home, I'd come home, it was a long day, post-call shift, 36 hours. And she said, Daddy, he's pulling on me, when I grow up, I want to be like you because you're my hero. Because every day you get to help people. You know, it was the kind of thing that my dad had been waiting for me to say, and I never really said to him. And here my daughter's telling me this, right? And it was this moment where I wanted to be able to tell her, like, this isn't a job, this isn't a profession, this isn't a career that we do. This is a sacred calling where every day we get to be with people when they're at their most vulnerable, and they let us. And in that sacred space between us, the decisions that we make ripple out into the world and into the community in ways that you can't measure, you can't click, you can't quantify, but they change lives every single day. It is a gift to be a healer. That's what I wanted to tell her. You know what actually happened? I said, hey, get out of here. I have 3 hours of charting an epic to do before I can go to bed and then repeat and do this again. And I remember that was the low point of my career because I realized I had gone into this as Hannah Montana and now I'm twerking for a living. And that's when I sort of hit rock bottom. It was one of those deals where you're like crying in the shower so that your wife doesn't know because you're already wet when you come out. Except my wife's a radiologist, so she actually knew because she like looks at stuff all day. And she was like, you know, I've never seen you this depressed. Like, maybe I read this book recently that was kind of interesting. Maybe you'll like it. It's called The Happiness Hypothesis. And I was like, oh, great. Some self-help book about happiness is just what I need. You know, we're cynical doctors. We don't read self-help books. And she said, it's not a self-help book. It's a book by a psychologist and a professor trying to study what makes people fulfilled. And it's really interesting. And I said, well, what's his name? And she said, Jonathan Haidt. And I was like, this is promising. This is promising. And so I got the book. And you know, it actually changed entirely the course of my life, which is weird. Books aren't supposed to do that, but this one did. And this is what I learned. So Jonathan is a psychologist. And again, he's like, what's going on with happiness? We're always struggling for it. We never find it. And he made this analogy. He said, the human mind is a mind divided into two parts, and they are not equal. The two parts are the elephant and this little rider on top of the elephant. And here's what he proposed, and it's based on not only decades of neuroscience and research, but also ancient wisdom going all the way back to Buddhism. and ancient Christianity, etc. And this is what he determined. The elephant is our primitive brain, the brain that's evolved over hundreds of millions of years that we share with dogs and animals like that. Emotion, hope, fear, disgust, our deep-held conditioned beliefs that are somewhat genetic and somewhat environmental, but they're unconscious. And this thing is a huge processor. It processes threats. When you hear a noise, you're like, huh? That's your elephant going, hey, turn around. Don't even think about it. Right? And this thing actually has been around forever, so it's ancient and it's hardwired. But look at this little guy. He's popped up in humans maybe just in the last 100,000 years. That's our neocortex. Critical thinking, planning, strategizing, memory, regret, math, worry. That's this little guy. And we like to believe, especially in medicine, that the writer runs the show, that reason controls emotion, and that he guides the elephant. But what really happens? Who's bigger? The writer is not the boss. What Jonathan Haidt proposes is that he's the press secretary. He's the guy who evolved because we're social creatures. He evolved to convince other people of why our elephant is right. So we've already made a decision, according to fMRI, up to 6 to 10 seconds before our writer is aware we've made a decision. Do you want chocolate or do you want vanilla? Vanilla. And then you click when you've made that decision, when you've already knew you were aware of it. 6 seconds prior, the part of your brain that chose vanilla has already lit up. And now your writer is explaining, why did you choose vanilla? I'm just feeling like really good about vanilla, bro, because vanilla's so dope, it's all silky smooth. He comes up with a post hoc explanation. It just happens the elephant loves frickin' vanilla, whether it's genetics or he's conditioned. So guess what? The writer is a press secretary for the elephant, and we know how that goes. You know what I'm so sad about this slide? It became outdated the minute I made it. Because if you pick any cabinet member, they're probably gone in the next week. I miss Spicy too, he's so adorable. Anyways, so if this is the case, what does it have to do with human happiness and behavior and my problem? Well, it has this to do. We ignore our elephant at our peril, and our writer makes up stories to explain why we're so pissed off. When I was a kid, the stories that I made up were, I'm a creative kid who's gonna use his unique gifts to change the world because my elephant is about humor and connection and empathy, and the path I'm walking on is a path to my calling, which is medicine. What happens year 8 at Stanford? Here's my writer's story. Man, I'm a failed creative who was forced into medicine by his parents, who is just waiting to make a mistake that's gonna get him sued or retire. And it's a historical fiction that the writer makes up to make there feel like there's some cohesion. And now my elephant is using its coping mechanism, humor, as a wall instead of to break walls down. And the path I'm walking on is health 2.0, the path we're all walking on. And I realize at this point what Jonathan Haidt said is, first of all, you got to recognize what's going on in your elephant. You got to listen to what the stories your writer is saying and recognize that either they're lies or they're truths. And then you got to look at the path and see if it needs to be changed. And how are you going to do that? Sometimes you have to wake up with adversity. So you get in an accident. A loved one gets cancer. You lose a child. Something terrible happens that makes you look at your calling and your purpose and your writer's story. Is it a story of connection and calling and purpose, or is it a story of regret? And what for me, it was as simple as my daughter coming to me with the stethoscope that woke me up. And I realized I have to change my elephant's use of humor. I need to change the path. We need to transform medicine. And my story needs to be one of connection and purpose because that's where happiness is. It's not found without. It's not found within. It's found between us through connections and purpose and a sense of being part of something bigger. And to do that, I realized I had to become a pimp. YouTube was coming up. It was 2010. I said, you know what? I'm going to get in touch with my passion about Weird Al and using empathy and humor, and I'm going to start talking to my patients' elephants and talking to my audience's elephants. We're going to motivate them with songs and with feeling and with hope and with disgust so that the behavior changes, because we in medicine are really good at yelling at the writer, hey, vaccines are safe and effective. Ryder doesn't care because the writer is the press secretary for the elephant. If the elephant's terrified of needles or scared of authority, it's not going to listen to that. You got to motivate that elephant by understanding where it is. And I said, what if I do this? I'm going to make parody songs. I'm going to put them on YouTube. We're going to motivate elephants to change the medical system and to keep Winnie the Pooh out of the hospital in the first place. And I'm going to do it while still being a full-time hospitalist at Stanford. And it's going to be dope. And I told the chair of my department my plans. And he said, yeah, it's going to be dope when you get a new job. Because that's totally unprofessional. Like, doctors don't go on YouTube. People are going to, they're going to point at us and say, what are you letting your docs do? And I said, cool, I guess kissing the ring never ends. It's a constant process in our profession. So I kissed the ring, and then I did it against medical advice anyways. And I created a character, Z-Dog MD, with two G's, because one is necessary but not sufficient to be a gangster. And I put it up on YouTube, and guess what? Stanford never figured it out. Until I got on the news. And then I did have to find a new job.
Entertainment that saves lives, that's today's big idea. Rapper Z-Dog MD is a board-certified medical doctor that sings parodies on healthcare.
I'm gonna make a change that might save my life.
The internet sensation has produced more than 50 videos, garnering over a million YouTube views. Why are you making these music videos?
So I found that by communicating with some humor and some music, you engage people in a way that's memorable.
I'm checking out my nets in the mirror. I feel my junk for lumps and stuff.
Doctors communicate very poorly about very important scientific things. They talk to the mind and not to the heart.
These ain't the kind of shots that kill Tupac. They put the brakes on polio so little kids could walk.
I got friends with low platelets, where the nosebleeds flow and prednisone chases my bruise away. Is my spleen okay?
Doesn't make for compelling TV, so let's make the same mistakes we made with HIV for Ebola. Ebola.
It's common for patients to be frustrated about not getting enough time with their doctors, but you're saying that also doctors are frustrated too.
But there's one voice
that no one knows. What does the doc say?
Your pills in the air if you got Medicare.
We change the culture of medicine and we focus on the things that we went into medicine to do, change the system and the administrative burden, we can actually fix healthcare.
All right. Dr. Zubin Damania, otherwise known as Z-Dog MD, something I'm probably never going to say on air again. Thank you so much for your time out of Las Vegas.
Oh, man. Oh, you will say my name again, sir. If I have to commit a felony to get on the news, it will happen. So, you know, this thing, here I was now, I reconnected with what my actual story was. And when you do that, crazy stuff happens. Like a huge tribe of healthcare people started to follow this weird enterprise because they saw in it the truth that everyone was scared to talk about, that they were worried they were going to lose their job or that their patients were going to judge them. I could say those things. And what ended up happening is we ended up transitioning to this Facebook platform where we do a Facebook live show called Incident Report almost every night with, you know, tens of thousands of viewers, most of them healthcare people, all there. They come for the funny stuff, but they stay for the discussion of how are we going to transform the path that our elephant and the rider are walking on to make it a path worthy of our calling, right? And the group of people that follow us are called the Z-Pack. Because they want to get me sued by Pfizer. And we decided, okay, now we have this platform. I ended up leaving Stanford and doing some interesting things in Las Vegas. By the way, Las Vegas strong. Thank you for all your support. And we said, you know what? It's time we actually motivated people's elephants about the big problems in healthcare. And one of them is the opioid epidemic. We in healthcare know the behavior we see from opioid-addicted patients, the drug seekers, right? But what happens when we look at that behavior and show love in the face of that suffering and understand what it is? It's very hard. So we did a little song about it. You want to hear it? It's called Blank Script because I love that Taylor Swift. You know what I'm saying? Here we go.
Appointment, I walk into your clinic complaining of pain. Doctor shopping once again. When I found you, I thought, oh my gosh, you really get me. Your last name's followed by an MD. You're my ticket to ecstasy. Pain relief. Stethoscope, coat and tie. I can play you like the lottery. Tears flow, crocodile, as I tell you about my three slip discs, chronic migraine. OMG, this abdominal pain. I define secondary gain. Did I mention I got allergies to Toradol and Motrin? Don't try to give me no NSAIDs. Won't take acetaminophen. You ain't dealing with a novice, son. My pain scale starts at 10. Got a long list of ex-doctors. They'll tell you I need help. Just give me my pain meds, baby, or I'll screw you on Yelp. I was young, I was reckless. I took things way too far. Never thought I'd get addicted. Now I'm higher than a shooting star. Got a long list of ex-doctors. They'll tell you I'm insane. But you've got a blank script, baby. And I've got some pain. Sweat is soaking through my clothes, and my brain doesn't want to work. It's not running down my nose, stomach cramping, I got the squirts. I puke till my throat's raw. This must be what it's like to withdraw. Wait, the worst is yet to come. Oh no, screaming, crying, I'm a jerk. Family left all because of my drugs. Sorry, I can't come to work. Must be yet another nasty bug. One script is all I need. Then you might think you're rid of me, but I'll come back each time I leave. Cause darling, I'm a junkie, dressed like your auntie. Being hooked on these knocks is like torture. All the lies, wasted life, can't take it no more. Being hooked, wanna quit, but I can't cope. All of this, a cry for help, you're my last hope. I was young, I was reckless. I took things way too far. Never thought I'd get addicted. Now I'm trying to score a fix in your ER. Got a long list of ex-doctors. They'll tell you I'm insane. But you've got a blank script, baby. And I've got some pain.
Oh, snap. It's real, though. So, you know, I got a lot of messages after that one from chronic pain people, right? And we know how those messages go. They're about four paragraphs long, explaining all the reasons that they are on narcotics and need to be on narcotics and everyone else is abusing it. And it starts a conversation, right, that continues. And that's what we need to do. We need to hit these things kind of head on with the elephant and then just gently direct the writer, right? And that we get that wrong so often. So hopefully we can start to move the needle. And speaking of moving the needle, it was weird. All these videos started this chain of events where since I was now back on the path that was right for me and I reconnected with my Hannah, I was still working full-time at Stanford. I got an email from this guy, Tony Shea, who is the CEO of Zappos, the shoe thing. And he had built it from nothing to a $1.2 billion sale to Amazon in 2008, and he's in Las Vegas. But he stayed on because he wanted to transform downtown Las Vegas into a place of community and connection. And I said, no, that sounds a lot like what we're trying to do with Health 3.0. And he emails me, and he's like, I'd like to come and have dinner with you and your wife. He went to school with my wife back in the day. And tell you this proposal that I have. And I'm not going to lie to you. A billionaire emails you and says he wants to come and have dinner with you and your wife to give you a proposal. And I swear, I was like, please, God, let this be an indecent proposal. I still have loans. I will take a hit for the team. And in a way it was. He said, listen, quit your job at Stanford, move to Las Vegas. I'll give you a little bit of startup money and you can make your videos. But more importantly, you can try to fulfill a model for this vision of Health 3.0. But it has to be in downtown Las Vegas, which is a demilitarized zone. And after kind of looking up healthcare innovation in Las Vegas and finding the first hit being the Hangover Heaven bus, I said, what do I have to lose? So we moved to Vegas, and for the first time, I was unplugged from the matrix, because the matrix means that your salary and your life and your livelihood depend on believing the truths of the matrix. And if you take the red pill, you could lose everything. And now my salary and my livelihood depended on finding a different way. And so I was able to see the matrix for what it was. And we'll show that pie graph up again. 4% of our healthcare dollars on primary care and prevention, and the rest on the failure of primary care and prevention. And this isn't a slight on surgeons or hospitals, it's just we know that this is true. We don't focus on prevention. And I didn't even add this up right when I first made this slide, because I think we're missing a percent. So I looked at it and I'm like, damn, let's see. I could ask my writer and go do a Google search, or I could ask my elephant. And my elephant was like, oh, hell yeah, I know what it is. My elephant likes Doritos, but he's not far off, right? And so in the setting of this, I said, how about this? Let's focus on a model that focuses on prevention, on teamwork, on collaboration, on technology to leverage that collaboration, and we're going to step out of the typical pay matrix. So it's not going to be fee-for-service. It's going to be fee-for-actual outcomes, and it looked like this. This was the trial that we did, Turntable Health. We started about 3.5 years ago in Las Vegas. We opened in partnership with Iora Health. It was a collaborative team-based primary care thing, and we were paid. So the way we were in a demilitarized zone in downtown Las Vegas. Nobody from the suburbs was gonna come out there and pay our per patient per month fee of $80. It just wasn't gonna happen. So we ended up partnering with the Nevada Health Co-op, which was an insurance company that started up with ACA loans early on. And they said, we'll pay your PMPM, and you will provide amazing primary care at the top of your license. You will collaborate with the local specialists, and you will keep people out of trouble, and you will show us outcomes that matter. And if you don't, we will fire you the next year. And we had like 3,000 patients instantly that were disadvantaged, that hadn't had health care in years. And this is what we did with them. We have a yoga teaching studio. This is Nina. She's our licensed clinical social worker, part of this really big team we showed here. She does behavioral health stuff, but she also teaches yoga meditation. So what she would tell patients is, hey, I know you're struggling, you know, your medication, everything is stable. On Thursday, I do a meditation class with other people who are suffering just like you. If you want to come, that'd be awesome, and you can learn from each other. And this is what they would do. They would learn to meditate, but that wasn't the deal. It was about forming connections with others who were suffering like them so that the 100-acre woods forms this network. And she's the hub, and they're the spokes, but it's really this mesh. And she gets to spend time with them in a way and understand them in a way that she never would otherwise. But they learn from each other, hold each other accountable. They get off medications. They keep coming, and it's transformative. And it's all free as part of the package that they got so that there isn't a barrier in terms of copays and episodes of care and transactions. It's a relationship. That's what Health 3.0 is. And so in the setting of that, we have these characters. Andrew here with the tats. So Andrew is a health coach. The way it works is like this. There are 3 health coaches to every doc. So the health coaches are drawn from the community. We screen 500 people in a speed dating to find 2. And it's based on emotional intelligence, right? So do I want to give them a hug? Do I want to tell them my life story? Then when that's whittled down, we look at their CV. And it turns out Andrew was a paramedic. Great, he can draw blood, he can intubate, he can do all this great stuff. But he's also a bartender at the Wynn Resort and Casino. And y'all in my tribe know that a bartender is really an entry-level psychotherapist. And so we got a psychotherapist. And remember, each of these health coaches rooms a patient for a minimum 30-minute visit. It's often more like an hour. Every patient gets a health coach. As the 3 health coaches room 3 patients, the doctors then get texted in and go room to room doing the high-level intuitive medicine that only doctors can do. But he does the blocking and tackling, forming a relationship, looking through the shopping list, setting up a pattern where he's gonna text and email and connect and hold this patient accountable. He comes from the community the patient comes from. When the doctor leaves the room, he tells the patient, now when the doctor said expectorates butonum, what he meant was hockaloogie. And he is a scribe. So he also helps offload some of the work. And so in the setting of that, you can actually get a good number of patients seen with amazingly high touch and great outcomes. We totally changed the way we designed the clinic. We made it open community space in the front. Everyone's welcome, the whole 100-acre woods. And then the clinical practice in the back. This is the front. So, and I got to say this. You guys are probably looking at this and going, this is a hell of a lot of overhead. It was. And guess what? We closed in January after 3 years. So I should say that up front because I'll tell you why. Our benefactor, the insurance company that was paying for all this, and I'll tell you how that went, they went out of business. So they had to close. They were put out of businesses by the Uniteds and the Anthems and the other big players in town. And they had to close like many of the co-ops around the country. There are many reasons for this, some of them political, some of them economic. And we lost 3,000 patients overnight and couldn't then cover our overhead. So we decided instead of continuing to do this, let's close this one and our partners, Iora, will grow this out of state. But so I want that to inform what you see here because you can do this without all this overhead and you can find new partners because the time for value over volume has come. The time for Health 3.0 is now. We were about 3 years too early. This is our open community space. There's an Xbox Kinect where people have to get up and actually move. There's no controller. So you'll see a 60-year-old dude dancing with a 5-year-old. They've never met. The mom's clapping in the background. Connections formed in the waiting room where people don't really wait. This is our teaching kitchen. There's Andrew teaching Winnie the Pooh how to cook in a food desert on a budget without a lot of time. Empower the patients, then hold them accountable through text, email, Skype, whatever methods to make them know we care about them so they care about themselves because they don't want to let either one of them down, right? Our rooms have EHR screens in every room so that when people are done being naked, you sit them down instead of their butt hanging out in the gown and you talk to them eye to eye with the chart in front of them because they see everything you're typing as you type it. It's their record, right? We're just the stewards of it. Which means you can't write 23-year-old drug seeker here to manipulate me. I've tried it. It doesn't end well. You have to collaborate with them and be transparent about what you're doing. And in the setting of that, we had to change our EHR. So our partners, Iora, created a brand new one that doesn't do CPT billing. It just does ICD-10 on the back end. It has a population health engine. It assigns every patient a worry score, 1 to 10. How likely is this patient to get admitted to the hospital in the next month? And then in our huddle, which we do every day, we reach out to all the 8s to try to keep them out of trouble, whether or not they're coming in. That's population health. And that worry score is partially technology and partially intuition. So the doc can move it up or down. And that's the marriage of tech and the human heart that is at the heart of Health 3.0. And unfortunately, our partners, Iora, called it the Iora Clinical Information System, or ISIS. Partners. These were our outcomes in a year, a 50% reduction in emergency room visits and admissions. And why? Because when you form a relationship with the patient, they will call you before they go to the ER. They've seen you for the things that would cause them to hit the ER in the middle of the night. And they trust you. And that's important. That relationship is important. We talk about patient satisfaction all the time, and we don't like it much. But what about this overall tech thing? We use something called Net Promoter. How likely, Mr. Patient, are you to recommend this clinic to family and friends? And we had a 90% positive Net Promoter in the first year, which is unheard of. And it subsequently drifted down to 88%, which was hurtful to us, but unsurprising, when your healthcare benchmark is at 35%. And we have another point here just for reference. Yeah. Now, I have no evidence for this, but it just feels right in my elephant, so I put it in. So that being said, what is Health 3.0? What does it look like? It looks like this. Half of our rooms were consult rooms where you just talk with patients. There's our doctor with our patient, eye to eye, with the chart tying them together instead of obstructing them. Health 3.0 takes it, one and two are a conflict, right? One says two are a bunch of automaton droids and need to be destroyed. We need to come back to one. Two says one are a bunch of whiny doctors who just want their power and money back and they don't do a good job in the first place. And three says, hey, children, stop fighting. You are both correct. If 1.0 is a shore, 2.0 is a boat. Most of us have one foot in the boat and one foot on the shore, and our crotch is ripping. 3.0 is the other shore. It says, let's take the best aspects of one, the sacred relationship between us and our patients, and let's restore it. But instead of being paternalistic, let's make it interpretive. It's a partnership. He has the time to know her hopes, dreams, and fears, and she has the capacity to hold him accountable, to be her shepherd through the process, and to know her as a unique person, and to bring all the technology of health 2.0 to bear. It's not clicking boxes to please a bean counter. It's knowing what the best evidence is for her, and then knowing that you can throw it all away if you have to. You're evidence empowered, but never evidence enslaved, because you're actually paid to generate outcomes. And there will come a day when we will do that. And that is the engine that will power Health 3.0, this transcendent, repersonalized, connected. He has a team supporting him of health coaches, nurses, doctors, social workers that provide the lift so that he doesn't have to do it all alone. And everybody practices at the top of their license in service of the patient, but also in service of each other. And the key here, as I wrap up, is that I realized something, that my gift when I was a kid was actually a curse. Empathy is terrible. I really don't like empathy. And it has very little place in Health 3.0. And let me explain what I mean. Empathy is feeling someone else's pain as your own and making decisions from that feeling. Now, when is that a good idea? If you take others' pain as your own, first of all, you are going to burn out, and we do. Or you're going to create a wall around yourself, and we do. We're really good at that. If you act from that feeling, you are going to make dumb decisions that actually don't serve the patient or the system as a whole. And empathy is a spotlight that shines on just one person at a time or one tiny group of people, often people that look and feel and sound like us. How is that a good thing? I would argue that in Health 3.0, we need compassion. Compassion is love in the face of suffering. It is a love that is unconditional. It is a love that can be practiced and cultivated. It is a love that grows stronger the more you use it, that does not burn you out, that does not judge a drug seeker, but rather recognizes their suffering and does not take it as your own, but understands that sometimes you have to be tough in order to help that person and alleviate their suffering long term. And compassion means we take care of each other. We stop pointing the finger at each other. We hold each other with love when we make mistakes. We're able to say, I'm sorry. That is the transcendent human aspect of 3.0 that's going to power this. And you know what? It sounds crazy and it sounds naive, and you guys are probably, half of you are thinking I'm insane. And the other half are like, I've been waiting for this forever. Like, this is why I went into it. And you know why I know it's going to work? I know it's going to work because Miley Cyrus went 3.0. Now, my dad, I showed him this slide, and he said, I bet she still has a lot of tattoos under that. And he's right. Because she has transcended and included the best of her previous selves, and that's what we have to do. Now, I want to end with a final song that is about all of us. I wrote it about primary care, but it's really about finding our calling in medicine, or finding our calling at all. What would I tell my child now if she said, I want to be a doctor? What would I look at my dad when he's such a role model for me? How would I honor him? And so I wrote this song. Now, the problem is we didn't do a proper sound check, and I like to blame the sound check, but it's really my inability to sing. And so I can't sing this song, but I'm going to try anyways. I don't want you to watch this song with your writer analyzing how bad I sing. I want you to feel this song with your elephant and look past that, because otherwise your writer's going to be really pissed at me. This song is called 7 Years. Those are my kids, my dad's 1973 projector.
Once I was 7 years old, my Daddy showed me the path to be a doctor can be lonely. Once I was 7 years old. It was a long, tough road, but we thought we were tougher. Pushing each other out the way as pre-meds we would suffer. By senior year I bought a suit for interviews. My mother was so confused because her son had turned into a gun. And once I was 20 years old, my daddy told me, don't be a PCP like me, do dumb please. Once I was 20 years old. Had that dream like my daddy before me. Be a healer, take the time to know my patient's story. The subspecialty glory just always seemed to call me. To make her primary, that passion always seemed to draw me. Soon I was 30 years old, trapped in a system that sucks souls. Insurance, EHR, Press Ganey owned me. Soon I feel 80 years old. One goal, hell 2.0's a failure, but I know with all our voices we can make it greater. I got my team with me, our time is now, not later. We love our patients, hate the system, let some break it major. Once I was 40 years old, our story unfolds. I was finally shown how 3.0 before me. Once I was 40 years old. Be 50 years old, our practice full grown. We've touched thousands of lives, but we're still learning. Soon I'll be 50 years old. Marvel at this life, my wife and children are me. And so I tell them how I'm touched by all my patient stories. I got my colleagues with me, we relive the med school glory. But those we've lost along the way, my brothers, I'm still sorry. Soon I'll be 60 years old. My daddy be proud of his son. Remember why we live this life, to make a better one. I made a man so happy when I saved his little son. I hope my children follow daddy into Madison. Soon I'll be 60 years old. Will I look back on my road and see a job I did? Hell no, I see a calling. Soon I'll be 60 years old. Soon I'll be 60 years old. Will I look back on the road and see a job I did? Hell no, I see a calling. Soon I'll be 60 years old. Daddy showed me the path to be a doctor can be lonely. Once I was 7 years old. Once I was 7 years old.
Guys, thank you so much. Oh, shucks, don't do that. I always get nervous when surgeons stand up. Guys, you are the ones who are going to build this. You know what your calling is. That's why you're here. Let's do this together. Join us. Be a part of this. I'm so honored to be with you, and thank you.